Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
New attacks tonight on Americans in Syria. John Berman here in for Anderson, and it came just hours after U.S. retaliation for a drone strike believed to be the work of Iranian-affiliated groups, which killed an American contractor and wounded five service members. And now another pair of strikes as President Biden speaks out for the first time on the situation. CNN's Oren Lieberman is at the Pentagon for us tonight. Oren, what's the latest on casualties among U.S. personnel there?
John, we're looking at four attacks in a number of different locations against U.S. personnel in Syria over the course of the past 36 hours ago or so. The first of those attacks was a one-way drone attack, a suicide drone attack in northeast Syria that left one U.S. contractor dead and six U.S. personnel injured. Five of those are U.S. service members. They're in stable condition at this point. Then, later on in the evening, there were 10 rockets fired at a Green Village site in central or eastern Syria, right about in that part. That led to no injuries. But when the U.S. retaliated, we saw two more attacks over the course of the past several hours. A rocket attack at nearby Conoco Field, again in central or eastern Syria, that left one U.S. service member injured in stable condition. And another drone attack, two of which were intercepted, two of those drones intercepted, one got through and damaged a facility there. John, it's been a long time since we've seen attacks of this nature and how quickly these have come in Syria.
You mentioned the U.S. retaliation. Describe that in just the one attack at this point, or has the U.S. talked about another retaliation?
So far, we've only seen the U.S. respond to that first attack, the drone attack that left a U.S. contractor dead, that targeting facilities used by groups with links to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. But President Joe Biden made clear there may be more responses as the U.S. watches this escalate. Here is Biden.
To make no mistake, the United States does not emphasize seek conflict with Iran, but be prepared for us to act forcefully, protect our people. That's exactly what happened last night.
The commander of U.S. Central Command made the same point that the U.S. has options and capabilities to respond should this continue. And John, if you look at it right now, if you look at the past several hours, it very much is continuing.
Or there are what, some 900 U.S. service members in Syria? How often do they come under attack?
Far more often than you might think. General Eric Kurilla, the commander of U.S. Central Command, testified just yesterday that since the beginning of 2021, there have been 78 attacks carried out by Iranian proxies in the region using either rockets or drones since the beginning of 2021. That averages out to one attack nearly every 10 days against U.S. forces there. So this happens fairly frequently. What's not frequent is when you see U.S. service members injured and U.S. contractors killed. And that's why it seems the U.S. may feel forced to respond again after those first strikes.
All right, Oren Lieberman, keep us posted because there seem to be developments every hour or so here. Joining us now, CNN military analyst and retired Army Lieutenant General Mark Hertling. General, let's start with the mere fact of this new round of strikes on U.S. forces. What does it tell you that U.S. troops were hit after President Biden ordered that retaliation?
You know, John, it's fascinating because as I heard you say earlier this morning, it was surprising, I think, to a lot of your listeners that there had been 78 attacks since January of 21. That's truthfully typical for these kind of combat zones. Rockets and missiles are fired arbitrarily near U.S. bases attempting to intimidate and harass. They very rarely hit. But in these cases, what you had is a drone that was the first strike two nights ago, and now additional strikes that seem to have ramped up. So you're probably going to see a tit for tat between the strike that was conducted by the two U.S. F-15s that hit a munitions storehouse and an intel collection site in northern Syria as part of a proportional response. And usually what happens after that, these Islamic militias will, or Iranian militias will come back and attempt to harass some more. If it's rocket and ballistic missile attacks, most of them do not hit anywhere near the targets. They are very poorly aimed and not very accurate. The thing that concerns me is the increasing use of these militias using drone strikes, the so-called kamikaze or suicide drones. That is more precise, and they can aim them in. Most of these bases, like RLZ and the Green Village, which Oren just talked about, have good air defense capability for these kind of things. But in the first case, what occurred the other night when that base was struck, there evidently, as the Pentagon reported, one of the Avenger missile systems was down for a reason, and it could be mechanics. Warfare is not perfect.
And you bring up the same point General Wesley Clark did with me this morning. The fact of the strikes isn't new. It's the precision which seems to raise the stakes here and is worth watching. How much communication do you think, General, occurs between Iran and these proxy groups believed to have carried out the strikes?
Oh, a lot. And John, truthfully, I have experience with this from our time in Iraq. My boundary of my divisional headquarters was on the border of Iran, and they were constantly pushing things across the border into their militia groups. Now, they have plausible deniability. This is not being done by the Iranian government, but it's certainly being done by people who are supported by the Iranian government, both with weapons and other kinds of equipment. You can't pinpoint it, but certainly they are connected. And when you're talking about the fight in northern Syria and the fight against the Kurds, these provincial militia or these popular front militia groups are certainly wanting to continue that fight against the Kurdish forces and, of course, against the U.S.
General, what's your main takeaway from President Biden's really two-pronged response here? On the one, he did order the retaliatory strike. On the other hand, at the press conference, he emphasized that he does not see conflict with Iran. If these attacks continue with precision, do you think the U.S. will have to escalate its response?
There is going to have to be a continued proportional and escalatory response against those using the weapons, John. And it was interesting to me watching General Carrillo, who's a good friend, saying, you know, he would not implicate Iran itself into these attacks. He was talking about the militias. It's not going to be a state versus state, even though we're going to probably continue to demarche and send warning signals to Iran, as the president did today. But I certainly believe that there will be proportional responses against the militia forces. And those are easy to attack. We have had less forces in northern Syria over the last couple of years. I think we're going to probably see more activity against the militia forces that are fighting against the Kurds.
General Hartling, if anyone understands the situation, it's you. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, John.
So now the former president, he is once again raising the specter of violence and inciting his followers, and he didn't even lose an election this time. No, this time he was up at 1 a.m. last night attacking a local prosecutor, calling him a degenerate, and figuratively unleashing the dogs of war on the entire country. What does that suggest about how he sees his situation and the larger legal storm he's facing? Some clues to be found in what he posted at 1 this morning on his social network about Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg and potential charges in the Stormy Daniels hush money investigation. He asks how it can happen when, quote, it is known by all that no crime has been committed, and also known the potential death and destruction in such a false charge could be catastrophic for our country. Why and who would do such a thing? His conclusion, only a degenerate psychopath that truly hates the USA. Now, this comes a day after he called Bragg an animal and posted this photo of himself getting ready to swing a baseball bat next to a photo of Bragg. And just today, Bragg's office received a package containing white powder and a threatening note. Now, the powder, thankfully, proved to be harmless, certainly less toxic than some on both sides of the aisle say the rhetoric is.
The twice impeached former president's rhetoric is reckless, reprehensible, and irresponsible. It's dangerous, and if he keeps it up, he's going to get someone killed.
Now, that's House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. His Republican counterpart, Steve Scalise, said there is no place in America for political violence of any kind. But he also echoed the former president, accusing Bragg of carrying out, in his words, a political vendetta. And Jim Jordan, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, dodged the question entirely. When shown the post by a correspondent for NBC, Chairman Jordan told him, in the correspondent's words, he can't read well without his glasses. Well, the former president apparently can, though, especially, it seems, the tea leaves, because the Manhattan case is only one of many, and they all seem to be coming to a head, especially this week, the federal documents investigation, with his defense attorney Evan Corcoran back before a federal grand jury today without attorney-client privilege to shield him from potentially damaging questions. There's that, and now a ruling that all of these former close aides cannot use executive privilege to avoid testimony before the January 6th grand jury. Put it all together, and there's plenty to keep anyone up at night. And tomorrow, the former president has a campaign rally in Waco, Texas. As we approach the 30th anniversary of this, the FBI raid on the Branch Davidian compound, a time and place and incident that has become a touchstone for violent anti-government groups and individuals. And though the Trump campaign says it is a coincidence, the Houston Chronicle today called the choice of location not just a dog whistle, but a, quote, blaring air horn of a Mach 18 wheeler, end quote, to extremists. Joining us now, someone who saw a Trump-incited mob up close on January 6th, former Republican congressman and senior political commentator for CNN, Adam Kinzinger. Also CNN senior law enforcement analyst and former deputy FBI director Andrew McCabe, and CNN chief correspondent Caitlin Collins. Caitlin, let me start with you. How are the former president's death and destruction comments being viewed inside the Trump camp? Because just days ago, his allies and advisors were privately urging him to tone down the rhetoric.
Yeah, they obviously didn't even want him to call for protest, really, in this situation. You saw people like Speaker Kevin McCarthy later saying that Trump wasn't calling for protest, even though he very explicitly did so on his own website, Truth Social. And so this is definitely an escalation, saying that there could potentially be death or destruction if he is indicted, as we know is pretty widely expected at this point, even though it's the timing of that that's unclear. And so this is certainly a cause for concern. I mean, it's been over a week now that I've been hearing from his allies who were saying they did not want to see anything that anywhere close resembled a January 6th playing out on the streets of Manhattan, because it was a major concern of theirs, given how damaging it's been for the former president. And so this just shows, though, I think that also his post, you know, almost a week ago now, when he said he was going to be arrested on Tuesday, which obviously was not borne out, and there was no indication that that was actually ever anything that was conveyed to his campaign or to his world. That just shows that he is allowing it to build. He is calling for protest. He's even kind of mocking Republicans who are saying that protest should be peaceful. He's saying they're trying to destroy our country, and people are calling for these, you know, peaceful protests in the wake of that.
So, Andrew, how much does this inflammatory rhetoric heighten the tension and security concerns of what may be a possible indictment next week?
Well, it should absolutely have heightened the security concerns of professionals who are involved in protecting not just New York City, but also Washington, D.C., and any place else around this country where extremist supporters of the former president might gather. I mean, look, what we're seeing here is predictable, and it shouldn't surprise anyone. He is a one-note orchestra. Donald Trump appeals to the lowest common denominator, the most baser, violent instincts of his most extreme supporters. He did it on January 6th. He summoned that mob to D.C. to try to, you know, obstruct the peaceful transfer of power. And he's doing it now to try to get himself out of trouble. And to be clear, he is in a lot of trouble. We all watched this morning while his attorney in the documents investigation entered the grand jury to testify against him. I mean, that is an unprecedented thing that we're seeing. And Evan Corcoran is in a position to provide unbelievably damaging testimony against him. Presumably that happened today. And now eight of his closest advisors have been told they cannot rely on executive privilege, and they must appear as well. So it's a very, very bad week for Trump, and predictably, he goes low and is resorting to the one thing that he does better than anyone, and that's appealing to people's violent tendencies.
You know, Congressman Kinzinger, knowing everything you know about the lead up to January 6th, you were on the January 6th committee. How concerning are these comments to you? And what does it say that you know, Chairman Jim Jordan and Speaker McCarthy aren't even addressing it?
So I'm concerned, not necessarily about what happens in the next week or 2 weeks. It's all this stuff radicalizes people over time. And people may continue to grow more thinking about violence and eventually going to violence. And it takes a spark that so far we still think, you know, oh, Trump, he'd never say like, hey, come and use violence on my behalf. But he easily could. And he's putting in people's minds to use violence. I got to tell you, John, the thing that bothers me the most, We could talk about this whole, it's the silence of my colleagues, my former colleagues. You know, every Republican who holds elected office has got to speak up. I don't even care if, you know, you don't have to do it on national TV. Put out a statement that says there is, the whole purpose, by the way, of politics is to prevent violence. That's why politics was created. The utter silence is so weak by my party that I just, that's what I can't believe, even more than what Donald Trump puts out on Truth Social.
All right. The three of you, if you will, please stick around. We're going to take a quick break. Next, more on Evan Corcoran's testimony today. You heard Andrew McCabe talking about it. Mine is the protection of attorney-client privilege. Talking tonight about the many legal troubles facing the former president and his extreme rhetoric in the face of it. Back now with our panel, Caitlin Collins. You know, as Andrew McCabe mentioned earlier, Trump's attorney Evan Corcoran appeared before the grand jury in the DOJ Mar-a-Lago investigation. And separately, several Trump aides, including Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Chief of Staff, have also been ordered to testify in the January 6th case. So is it clear, Caitlin, how all of this is being seen and viewed by the former president?
I mean, clearly there's a lot going on, and he just commented on this a few moments ago, both Evan Corcoran going and testifying today without being able to cite attorney-client privilege to not answer certain questions, and also the fact that Mark Meadows, his former chief of staff, and all of these other aides with, you know, varying levels of closeness to him will also have to testify without being able to rely citing executive privilege to block their testimony in the respective January 6th case. And so it is notable. I think Evan Corcoran, though, has been probably the highest on the radar for a lot of those in the former president's inner circle because he was going to testify today. He was there for about 3 hours. Our camera saw him going in and then leaving. And obviously there were major questions that we know that they wanted to talk to him about regarding his conversations with Trump on what happened as they were searching for these classified documents, as, of course, when the FBI showed up at Mar-a-Lago in June before that search warrant was executed. Evan Corcoran played a role in drafting that statement about the search of classified documents. He was the one who was on the receiving end of those subpoenas that they got and was dealing with the Justice Department in that regard. So I think they have major questions on that front when it comes to this. But then when you step back and look at it, yes, you're right. The broader context of all of the level investigations into him, he's the most vocal right now about what's happening in Manhattan. But as you've heard from legal experts, they believe potentially the documents now with Evan Corcoran testifying January 6th in Georgia or other major ones that are all, you know, if they're not high on the radar, they certainly should be.
You know, Andrew McCabe, you know, you mentioned this has been a very bad week for Trump, largely because of the Evan Corcoran testimony. Does it seem like the pace of the special counsel investigation, documents and January 6th is quickening because his team is really notching some court victories here?
It does, John, and particularly on the document side. So if we think about everything we learned from the affidavit supporting the search warrant last summer, and then what's taken place largely in sealed court hearings over the last couple of months, what we learned in this effort to pierce the attorney-client privilege between Trump and Evan Corcoran is, according to Judge Howell, the Department of Justice presented enough evidence to convince her that Donald Trump had actually committed a crime or attempted to conceal a crime in his interactions with his attorney, Evan Corcoran. So having made that sort of an evidentiary presentation to a district court judge and having had her decision approved by the circuit court, it is almost impossible to imagine that Jack Smith's team will not indict Donald Trump, at least on the documents case. They've already presented compelling evidence in the course of this motion hearing. So we're definitely past, I think, a critical stage in that investigation. Now, with the new folks, those eight close advisors who have been whose claims of executive privilege have been wiped aside, at least by at the trial court level, the January 6th investigation is ready to get a surge of adrenaline as well.
Well, let's talk about that investigation. Let's talk about one of those potential witnesses, Congressman Kinzinger. If anyone knows Mark Meadows, it's you. You served with him. And then he became White House Chief of Staff. He infamously didn't testify before your House committee, the January 6th committee. How significant do you think his testimony would be?
Oh, it'll be very significant. I mean, I consider him like the MVP of the January 6th House investigation because initially he turned over quite a few text messages before he became, you know, totally uncooperative. Those text messages, those were some of the things that opened up a lot of the leads we were able to chase to get to the compelling information we got. Mark Meadows knows a lot. He knew a lot. And I got to tell you, with all these Dan Scavino and some of these others that have resisted coming in and testifying to the January 6th committee, know a lot more. And keep in mind, I think our committee put forward a pretty compelling case in the first place. Now you layer onto that these folks that didn't cooperate, that will cooperate because DOJ has a much better ability to force that. If I'm the former president, I'm going to be nervous because those excuses and those lies and frankly, those misperceptions he made, those are going to come tumbling down.
You know, you called Mark Meadows the MVP. Remember, he didn't even testify your committee, just the documents. I suppose the question is, will he pull Frank Thompson and be back-to-back MVPs with the January 6th investigation? Adam Kinzinger, Andrew McCabe, Caitlin Collins, thanks to all of you. Happy weekend. Next, how the former president's Florida neighbors see this story and the man next door, and the legal slippery slope that is the lawsuit and countersuit over a ski collision with Gwyneth Paltrow. The former president making outlandish statements online, nothing new. What could be different this time, though, is how much tolerance there still is for it. Our Randy Kaye spent today talking to people who can legitimately call him a neighbor. She joins us now. Randy, what did you find?
Well, John, we went to Palm Beach Island, where Mar-a-Lago is, so it's essentially Donald Trump's backyard. And we spoke with voters about how they feel about this possibility of the former president being indicted and also about some of his language that he's been using on social media. Here's what one Republican woman who voted for Donald Trump told me.
What do you think about the rhetoric and the language he's using?
Like I said, it's harsh.
Yeah. Is it irresponsible?
Very.
Do you think Donald Trump is getting railroaded?
No, I don't think so.
You think it's a fair investigation?
I think so.
Now, she did vote for Donald Trump, but she also told me that if Ron DeSantis, Florida's governor, jumps into the race in 2024, that she would be voting for Ron DeSantis. We also spoke to one man named Herbert, who also voted for Donald Trump, and here's what he had to say.
I think it's horrible. A dozen destruction. I think he's got a big mouth. He should keep his big mouth shut.
Do you think he's being railroaded in New York, or you think it's a fair investigation of the hush money payments?
I think he's being railroaded. Yeah, I really do.
Why is that?
It's all political. I mean, what happened there, it happens all the time. I mean, not only to him, to other celebrities and so forth.
Now, remember, John, he voted for Donald Trump, but he told me that if it ends up being Biden against Trump again in 2024, he would strongly consider voting for Joe Biden, which I thought was very interesting. We also spoke to a Republican couple who supported Donald Trump in the past. They are still supporting Donald Trump, but they are tiring of his rhetoric. Listen.
What do you think about that sort of language being used?
Well, I think it's not language that should be used by a former president, but I also think he's got the raw deal with everything that he's being charged, you know, and I think that it's basically politically motivated. But if he learned how to say things with a lesser tone, I think we'd be better off for him.
That's really interesting to hear, Randy. And those were all largely Republicans. Did you speak to any Democrats?
We spoke to a handful of Democrats, John, and they pretty much all gave us the same sentiment. They certainly are frustrated with the former president. They feel he's continuing to divide this country. Here is what one Democrat told me, and it really does sum up what the others told us.
I don't think that Mr. Trump really has a grasp on reality in terms of the big picture of the health of the country, and I don't feel that anything he's saying is helping bring us together. I don't think that calling for people to defend him and all that kind of stuff is helping heal the wounds of the last 6-8 years, which this country desperately needs to do to go forward.
And it is worth noting, John, that the Democrats and Republicans that we spoke with do agree on one thing. They all believe that Republican leadership should step in and tell Donald Trump to tamp down some of that rhetoric. John?
All right. All very interesting. Randy Kaye, thank you very much. Perspective now from CNN political commentator and Democratic strategist Paul Begala. And a bit to his right from CNN political commentator Jonah Goldberg, co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Dispatch. You know, Jonah, it's interesting because Randy also told us that she talked to a lot of people who just didn't want to talk about Trump. They were just sick of him. So you have, you know, for a guy who craves attention, people who don't even want to think about him right now, combined with those Republicans who seemed a little sick of him. How much do you think that hurts Donald Trump?
It's sort of impossible to tell. I do think over the long haul, there is this building thing of it's always something with this guy. Like, you heard some of these people saying that they're sympathetic and they think he's being railroaded. But look, I mean, like, you can think somebody in the NFL was badly treated or, like, in the NBA was fouled and they got injured. If they're injured, you don't want them, you know, starting in the next game. Similarly, Donald Trump is really damaged goods at this point, and I think there are a lot of Republicans who like him who think, you know, look, he's just not the winnable candidate. And some of this stuff is dragging. We now know from 2022 that he's dragging down other Republicans. Enough is enough. I just don't know if you're going to get enough of vote people to think that in time for it to matter in the primaries. It remains to be seen.
Look, it's a small sample size, but it did sound like there was fatigue in some of those Trump supporters' voices there. Paul, look, Donald Trump lashing out like he is, these 1 a.m. statements on social media seeming to incite violence or call for it, perhaps. What does it say to you that that's how he's reacting to what is widely seen as a less serious case here in Manhattan? What does it tell you about how he might react to the more serious cases in Georgia in the federal investigation?
That's a really good point. One of my old mentors and friends, the late Zell Miller, governor of Georgia, used to say, a hit dog will holler. Well, if he's this upset and this worried and threatening violence, which is way across the line, about a case that even a lot of Democrats think, gee, I don't know if they ought to bring it. Wait until, I just heard Andy McCabe talking about the evidence that the feds are gathering in the classified documents case. Wait until a potential case around incitement of insurrection on January 6th. Wait until perhaps the 10 or so instances of obstruction of justice that the Mueller report cites. Wait until Fonnie Willis, the DA in Fulton County in Georgia, potentially brings a case. Those are much, much more serious. But if he's starting now with what for him should be actually the easiest case, and he's resorting to threats of violence, God only knows where he's going to go next.
You know, Jonah, Adam Kinzinger earlier expressed dismay that Republican members of Congress largely still aren't speaking out against the violence. He seemed to think they were scared to speak out. But how much of a risk do you really think there is now in speaking out, particularly if some of these Trump supporters we heard in Randy's piece right there are so exhausted with Trump?
Yeah, look, I mean, this is a bind that Republicans have been in for a very, very long time. This is a very Groundhog Day kind of question. No offense to the question, but we've seen this for 7 years now, and there's just essentially a calculation that says you catch a lot more grief if you say anything than if you just keep your head down. I think it's shameful. And look, I mean, on the violence thing, I just think it's really worth pointing out. Let's credit Trump's defenders and Trump himself and say that he was absolutely right when he says he didn't mean to incite violence on January 6th. That was not his intent. You would think, given what happened on January 6th, you'd be extra careful not to do it again. And yet he's going completely the other way. He knows what he's doing. It is wicked. And it is profoundly dangerous. And like I the man on the street interviews are interesting, but they all say, oh, Republicans should intervene. Every Republican who's ever intervened with him has gotten their head handed to them, going back to Jeff Flake. So I'm not sure it's a strategy that a lot of Republicans want to follow.
You know, Paul, we got about 30 seconds left. And I do understand the groundhog nature of it. My question is, has something changed right now? Is there now a fatigue? You have advised almost all only Democratic candidates, Zell Miller ultimately aside, arguably, right at the end there. But what would you advise someone like Ron DeSantis?
Hit him. Hit him as hard as you can. Beat him. If you want to beat Trump, you have to beat Trump. And I think Jonah's right. In the past, people who've taken on Trump have suffered. He has crossed a line with this violence. By the way, set aside politics, there's a moral imperative here. There's social science research on this. There's this political scientist at Johns Hopkins, Lillian Mason, who studied political violence. And she found when you introduce a statement from a leader to people who might be inclined toward violence, it has significant effect on diminishing the violence. So this is really important. The political violence in this country is on the rise. Republicans have got to speak out about this or someone's going to get hurt. And I think it's going to help them politically if they do.
Paul McGallagher, Jonah Goldberg, our thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So a problem that might shock you by its very existence in this country, places where clean drinking water is unavailable. According to the World Economic Forum, around 2.2 million Americans are without running water or basic indoor plumbing, and more than 44 million have inadequate water systems. Sounds almost unimaginable, but it's not, as CNN's Sarah Savner find out in McDowell County, West Virginia.
Inside this dilapidated building, where the roof is always threatening to cave in, sits one precious item.
What in the heck is this?
That is an old turbine pump.
That decade-old pump is the only source of reliable clean water for about 300 residents. It's the only pump left that sends water through the pipes into their homes. Randy Whitaker does his best to help maintain it.
If you look at the facility, you think, no.
You think, no, I'm not drinking any of that.
Right, but it meets all regulatory standards.
We were there when the head of the Environmental Protection Agency got a tour of the place in December. Michael Regan's first initiative is to bring reliable, clean water to historically neglected communities across America.
I walked into a building that's leaking, that has ancient technology, and people's livelihoods are dependent upon this antiquated system. This is not what we should be having in this country.
The residents serviced by this pump actually have it good, compared to thousands of others in the county, gathering rain or creek water.
What is one thing you don't have in this house?
We don't have water.
Sonny Barton has lived on this remote ridge for 40 years. He says their mountain community was promised pipe water when he first got here, but it never happened. So he hauls water himself.
I pump it on my truck, Bill.
Out of the creek?
Yeah.
Just straight out of the creek?
Yeah, straight out of the creek.
You go fill those up.
Fill them
at the
up.
Creek. Okay.
And I drop it off here.
Down in the valley.
I put my shiplap up over top of my cabinets. I painted my cabinets.
Tammy Bailey put some serious sweat equity into her home.
So one day I come home and I turned my tap on, not this faucet, of course.
Yeah.
And when I turned my tap on, this is what I got. This was my water.
Okay. That, you can't even see through that. What'd it smell like?
Nasty rotten eggs.
What's worse, when Bailey had her water tested, she says 14 contaminants were found.
You couldn't even flush a toilet. No cooking.
And none of the 1,200 or so homes in her part of McDowell County are hooked up to a reliable water source.
We're supposed to be the best country in the world.
The richest.
The richest country in the world.
Some 100 years ago, some residents here were among the richest people in the United States by mining coal.
We know that historically these coal companies and other extractive industries were the ones who paid for, operated, and maintained all of these town water systems. The communities then have to rely on infrastructure that is aging, failing, breaking down.
100 years later, the tax base and infrastructure generations of families rely on is a shadow of itself.
My grandmother, this is me and her, she didn't have running water until she was 70.
She didn't have running water until she was 70 years old.
Yes, ma'am.
What Eddie George does is help people all over McDowell County get water piped to their homes.
People, they have trucks just solely devoted to carrying water, hauling water from, you know, a spring.
He works for a nonprofit organization called Dig Deep. Tammy Bailey says she would still be living without clean water if it weren't for Eddie and Dig Deep.
I'm a single woman, one income, so I went knocking on the doors of Dig Deep, and fortunately they answered.
The cost to fix everything that went wrong would have cost her $10,000. Statistically, that's about a third of a year's wages for most people in McDowell County. Eddie George points out the problem isn't just about how people get water, but what's in it.
These are what we call straight piping. It's dumping raw sewage into the stream.
This lovely stream runs right through Tammy Bailey's neighborhood, but every house we see has a straight pipe straight into it. The people we heard from here desperately want to be hooked up to a water system, but have little hope it will happen anytime soon.
In an area like this, you're, I think, 13 to 14 miles away from any main water source.
But Eddie George does see a trickle of hope because for the first time ever, the head of the EPA came to McDowell County and pledged to help fix what has been broken for far too long.
If you come down some of these places, you would think you was in a third world country. Nobody should have to live like this.
Nobody should have to live like that. When you see what these folks go through every day just to get water into their homes, it makes you angry. But they have said to me things like, so we can get people to the moon, we can send a rover to Mars, but we can't get water to our homes, we can't have city pipes. There is a funding issue, of course. But I think a lot of people see this and think, oh, well, that's, you know, that's part of being in rural America. No, no. The cities also have major issues. We just saw what happened in the capital of Mississippi, Jackson. We all know what happened in Flint. The infrastructure in our country is problematic. And you couple that with climate change, and this is going to get worse, according to every expert we spoke with.
No one should be having these problems. No. Not in America. My soon-to-be co-anchor, Sarah Seidner, great
Looking
to have
forward
you
to
here.
It. Thank you, John.
All right, Gwyneth Paltrow takes the stand. And believe it or not, it's topic A tonight for numbers guru Harry Yen. Actress Gwyneth Paltrow took the stand today in a civil trial over a 2016 ski accident in Park City, Utah. A retired optometrist says she skied right into him and is suing for about $300,000, alleging he suffered 4 broken ribs and brain damage. Now, Paltrow says he skied into her and is countersuing.
I was skiing and 2 skis came between my skis, forcing my legs apart. And then there was a body pressing against me and there was a very strange grunting noise. So my brain was trying to make sense of what was happening. I thought, is this a practical joke? Is someone like doing something perverted? This is really, really strange. My mind was going very, very quickly and I was trying to ascertain what was happening.
All right, CNN's Harry Enten joins us. Now, Harry, look, there's a lot going on in this trial, and the testimony back and forth is interesting, but there's also some other interest in just sort of the numbers surrounding it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, for Gwyneth Paltrow, this is not about money. This is about her reputation, right? Because her group company is worth well over $200 million. The suit is for only $300,000. Now, she's countersuing, but it's just for a dollar and attorney's fees. So this is more about her reputation. She wants to clear her name. And so we'll see if she's ultimately able to do that.
How much attention is this case getting? It's televised. You get the sense that people are interested.
People are really interested. So I contacted Google and I found out that this is the day that has had the most searches for Gwyneth Paltrow in 9 years. 9 years. Her Google searches today are the third highest since Google has been tracking it back in 2004. So people are really interested in this case. They were interested in seeing Gwyneth Paltrow take the stand. And again, this is about her reputation, so we'll see if the people who are so interested in it view her differently, better or for worse, based upon her testimony.
You know, when I introduced her and we talked about her, I say actress Gwyneth Paltrow, but truth is, she's more of a business person now than an actress. I listened to an interview with her over a year ago. She says, yeah, it's been a long time since I was the major name in a film.
Yeah, I went back and I looked, and the last time she received top billing, the top billing in a film, was 13 years ago. 13 years ago for a film that I honestly had never heard of. You can see on the screen, Country Strong. I believe she...
Apparently not so strong.
Apparently not so strong. I was told the movie wasn't particularly good, but I also know that she performed at the Country Music Awards, and that was, in fact, the last time a performance of hers was something that was searched in the top 5 searches for Gwyneth Paltrow's name. As you mentioned, she's really just not known for her performances anymore. She's perhaps now known more about this trial, which, again, is part of the reason why she's so eager to clear her name.
Very interesting. Harriet, and great to see you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Just ahead, a sneak peek at the premiere of a new CNN series guaranteed to leave you hungry. Eva Longoria searching for Mexico. Sunday night, CNN premieres an exciting new original series. Searching for Mexico was hosted by actress, producer, and director Eva Longoria. Anderson spoke with her about it.
What made you decide, I mean, you're incredibly busy. What made you want to do this?
Well, Stanley Tucci called me. Mm-hmm. You know, Searching for Italy was such a success for CNN and for the world. We all, you know, I think we drove everybody to Italy to visit all the places he ate at. And he called me, he said, we want to do a spinoff of the Searching For series. He knew I was you know, a big foodie. I'm a big cook, not a chef. I'm a cook, and I'm Mexican American. You know, and him being Italian American and so tied to his Italian roots, he knew I was, you know, tied to my Mexican roots, and he thought it would be a good idea. And once we dove into to it, it was like, I was like, yes, I mean, yes, because Mexico is a jewel of culinary cuisine. Incredible cuisine.
You, I mean, you were born in Texas, but have strong Mexican roots.
Yeah.
So where the first episode we're going to see is Mexico City, which is, I mean, obviously.
I live there now. I live in Mexico
City. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, with my husband.
I mean, Mexico City is one of the greatest cities in the world. It's incredible.
Incredible. Yeah. And gastronomically. Incredible. It's like one of the biggest food destinations in the world today.
What is it about, for somebody who hasn't been in Mexico City, what is...
Well, Mexico City is way more advanced than a lot of cities here in the United States. Like, culturally, it's just, it's so stunning. And obviously, food plays a big part of that. But I think the Mexican identity is so rooted in tacos and tequila, you know, that we all think Mexico's only tacos, tacos, tequila, which they do very well. And I love, like, don't get me wrong, but it's so much more. And I think Mexico City is a microcosm of that diversity. It has everything. Mexico City has great seafood, and it has, you know, great decolonized food. It has great meats. It has everything.
And the art scene there is incredible. The museums there are great. It's just it's such a joy to be in that city.
It is a beautiful city.
I fantasize about living in Mexico City.
You do? You should come. Come and visit us. We'll take you on. I'll take you on my food tour.
I love the Frida Kahlo house. I love
the Frida Kahlo house, the pyramids. Yeah. So many varieties of corn. Red, blue, black, purple. They're beautiful colors. And they're all, the species are dying because the only corn that globalization wants is white corn. And so the farmers don't really have a reason to plant the other species. And so there's a bit of a crisis there. But it's beautiful when you see it in the Oaxaca episode, just all the variety of colors and the beauty of what the farmers can create. And then also there was a woman, a mezcal maker, and they call her La Bruja, which is the witch, because she makes the best mezcal, and they think that she's using some sort of witchcraft because she sells the most.
Did you sample?
Of course I sampled mezcal. Yes, I did. There was a whole mezcal story we do in Oaxaca, and it was that was a tough week for me. I was like, I need a detox after this.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Good
for being
to see
with us.
You. Yeah. You have to come to Mexico City, and I'll take you to some of the most amazing places.
I would love that.
The CNN original series Eva Longoria Searching for Mexico premieres Sunday at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific right here on CNN. And right now, the CNN primetime special, The Ted Lasso Phenomenon, Jason Sudeikis, one-on-one.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.